You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 18th of October, 1919. We have been reflecting in all kinds of ways on how a healing of our social conditions and other circumstances affecting human community can only come about if, from within, we allow other modes of thinking to take hold of us than those which have become dominant over the last 3 to 4 centuries. One such especially influential mode of thought, scientific thinking, ought no longer to hold sway over us. Nowadays, it is difficult to speak of this scientific thinking completely impartially, because it is undoubtedly true that humanity has made enormous advances by means of it. At the same time, though, we must realize that modern advances of this kind have suppressed a true life of spirit and culture. Gradually, progress has come to involve aspects of human knowledge that could subsequently be utilized in external technology. And the rest of cultural life was then touched also by this tendency, always to orient human thinking to what can be utilized in external technology. It would be quite wrong to think that I am referring here only to everything in modern culture that is directly dependent on the scientific mode of thinking. No. What I mean is that the whole way of thinking of modern humanity, except where old ideas, old elements have been grafted onto this thinking from the past, is of a kind which comes to expression in an extreme form in scientific thinking. Not only people directly affected by science think scientifically. In fact, though paradoxical, it is true to say that people directly involved in and influenced by science are furthest from the type of thinking I am here referring to. A general mode of thought has come to particularly characteristic expression in science, so that, in a sense, we can best see through the scientific lens how modern humanity thinks. We have often spoken of the influence of this manner of thinking, which comes to especially characteristic expression in science. And now I want to point to a peculiarity inherent in our thinking, our whole mind, our whole modern sensibility in general, because the soul is so much informed by scientific impulses. The peculiarity is this: that as modern human beings, we have in a sense lost the ability to observe things impartially. People believe that they do so, but they do not. Our very education today inoculates us with a large sum of predetermined ideas that color the way we see things, so that we no longer have a vision untainted by these concepts. You might well think that this fact, that we do not have an untainted vision of things, would be most apparent and injurious in scientific inquiry, in science. One might well think this. But on closer inspection, something more becomes apparent. Scientists are saved from the ruinous and devastating fact of not properly seeing things by increasingly directing their attention to the external sense world alone, to what is presented to our outward senses. These outward senses are not governed, you see, by predetermined ideas. And so they continually correct and adjust what arises from such views, thoughts and opinions, especially from preconceptions. Observation itself continually corrects the views and judgments we otherwise impose on perception. And this is why we do not notice all kinds of preconceptions that do also inform scientific observations. If we take scientific findings in their context, we find that scientific observations bear the imprint of predetermined ideas and views. And yet this lack of capacity to see any longer is particularly injurious when we start thinking about social conditions. Here the realities in no way correct or amend the preconceptions that people impose on them. Ultimately, therefore, we have come to the point when people can claim and assert whatever they like about the social realities of life. Nowadays, all kinds of opinions are asserted. On the one hand, that social reality consists only in economic processes, that all spiritual life is only a kind of superstructure, a sort of smoke that rises from it, an icing on the cake of economic factors. That is one extreme. The other is this. Since people have no sense of real spiritual agencies alive in the world, they talk of prevailing abstract ideas, ideas about things and so forth, and claim that these ideas, perhaps through human agency, shape the external realities of economic and other factors. Two opposite views, as you can see. Now, when it comes to proving one view or the other, you can cite indisputable evidence for either, of equal validity in both cases. It can be proven that everything is governed by prevailing ideas, and equally, that this is pure fantasy, and that in reality all ideas are only reflections, only a superstructure overlaid upon economic factors. One person can neatly refute what the other claims. In both cases, the proofs are perfectly valid. This phenomenon has been ignored far too much in the culture of our day. People divide themselves into factions or parties and propound a particular maxim, some program or other. They are convinced they are right, and that their mottos and programs are backed up by proof. Others propose quite different maxims, a quite different program. They too can back up what they say with evidence, and it is not possible to say that the reasoning of either is better or worse. We really should take note of this phenomenon in political life, since it is the most typical trait of our time. Ultimately, it leads to the gravest antisocial factors and moods. You see, if you are convinced by a particular motto, and have good reasons to offer for it, you easily regard someone else of a different persuasion as an idiot or rogue, or in some other way dishonest. It is a tragedy of our time that this is not really understood. On top of this comes the fact that people today believe that the human soul has always been constituted as it is today. And as soon as you draw attention to the phenomenon I described, it is fairly predictable that someone will reply that this has always been so in humanity's history, that all opinions have always been able to coexist with equal logical coherence. But if people would only take the trouble to inform themselves about the real nature of human evolution, they would not assert this. In truth, such a state of affairs did not always prevail. Well-proven views, maxims, and programs did not always stand in such clear definition alongside each other as they do today. Nowadays, if you're as clever as some left-wing socialists, you can easily and clearly prove the tenets of Marxism. Or otherwise, if you wish to adopt a different perspective, you can prove equally well that Marxism is complete nonsense. It is important to be aware today that excellent proofs can be offered to back up very opposed standpoints. Children today are taught to prove things. They are, as it were, inoculated with this capacity. And in fact, this is something immensely sad, that everything can be proven so clearly and rigorously, and in consequence, people can be so strongly persuaded something is true. Of all the ways of persuading someone, offering proof is the easiest today. There is no easier way to persuade someone you're right. And precisely through this ability to prove things, people have completely lost their proper sense of the need to work hard, to struggle to acquire one's convictions in life, that a battle must be waged within, that one has to overcome oneself if a real conviction is to take hold in the soul. To what is this due? This fact so incisive in our lives, of being able to prove things so easily. It is because we are accustomed to confining our thoughts only to the surface of things. Nowadays, people ensure their thinking lies strictly upon the surface of things, and they make no efforts to delve deeper. And the more superficially one thinks, the easier it is to prove whatever you like. It is very important indeed to recognize this. The thinner our concepts are, and at the surface of things all concepts become thin and abstract, the more easily these concepts seem to offer evidence for whatever one wishes to think and believe, which arises, in fact, from quite different subterranean origins, feelings, hidden intentions, and such like. Our whole factional politics ought to be studied and described from this perspective I have just described. But what can least be achieved as we study things only in this superficial manner is real insight into human nature. And that is why so many people today are now urging that we deepen our ideas at last, developing, for instance, self-knowledge, or in other words, insight into our own being. Countless books, lectures, briefings, and campaign leaflets speak of the need for such insight. But this in turn requires a sound basis. You cannot acquire it from any random point of departure. To get beyond the miserable plight of resorting to evidence and proof, we need to learn to see things with an open mind, simply to learn to see things in outward life as they actually are. Learning to see things as they are is especially necessary for our healthy sense of things, for a healthy view of the world. For this is what we have most lost sight of. We can prove how things ought to be, but we don't perceive their reality, see them as they are, since truly seeing is harder than proving them to be a particular way. Certain assertions made today in the social domain, for example, are only arrived at by proving things. If instead we develop an unprejudiced eye for reality, we cannot arrive at such assertions. The thing of most importance is to develop real perception of things, really to see them. If you read Goethe's scientific writings, and also his writings about art, you will see that in his day already, he was trying to strongly urge the practice of open-minded seeing. He recognized how the sciences all work out of concepts reliant on proof, and he thought this especially was something that needed to be overcome. What he wanted, above all, was to acquaint himself with the phenomena themselves, the archetypal meaning of facts and realities, really to acquaint himself with them as they are. His efforts largely fell on deaf ears. Today this foundation, on which Goethe attempted to let realities themselves speak to him, the foundation of his theory of colors, for instance, is still a field where his right to contribute to our understanding is hotly contested. But for insight into human nature, it is especially necessary to develop true sight of the realities of life, of subjective life. People today, for instance, speak a great deal of external and internal phenomena in relation to human experience. It seems to me that if you were to ask many people today whether the color red, or a particular tone, or something else they perceive in their surroundings, is an inner or outer reality, they would say it is an outer one, external to them, in contrast to inner experience. And then, if you ask them whether they can articulate the difference between outer and inner, they will say with some assurance that they are very clear about it, that what the senses perceive is outside them, and what is within and belongs to the human being himself is inner. You may pursue these questions further, and ask a person about these external things, the green grass, the blue sky, the rising sun, and so on. People can express what they observe in these terms, describing each phenomenon separately and specifically. But if you then ask someone to itemize what they call their inner experience in the same way, the great majority of people will find it hard to offer any clear answer, or at least one involving detailed facts and realities. They have the illusion that they know this inner life very well, compared with outward realities. But if you probe a little and ask them to describe their inner life in as much detail as they describe outward things, you will find they don't get very far. If, however, someone does really succeed in describing inner experience, it becomes apparent this is nothing other than a reflection of external reality. Everything that has arisen and developed in relation to the outer world, preserved in paler form in a person's memory. It will be a little different from the outer phenomena he has described. A person today is unlikely to be able to tell you more about his inner life than, at most, how he feels in response to the green of the grass and the blue of the sky. He will find it very difficult to describe a real contrast and distinction between inner and outer. This has considerable consequences. It means people are unable to properly grasp the distinction between inner and outer experience in any meaningful sense. You see, scientists, from their modern perspective, try to investigate the human organs as supposed bearers of inner processes. They try to prove things without really perceiving them, saying, for instance, that a table is outside us, and inner life is within. And in referring to inner experience, especially in science, they point to the interior of the skull, equating it with inner life. Here they transpose ideas gained from unclear perception into the human body, and say that inside there, somewhere between the eyes, is inner life. And there's a drawing. Some who delve deeper may perhaps question these concepts, but unconsciously at least, people do think that the outer world is under their fingertips, while inner life sits behind their eyes. This, however, with the consequences drawn from it for the bodily organs, is founded only on imprecise perception. In fact, everything that you are entitled to call your interiority is what you experience in the so-called outer world. You are continually interwoven with the outer world, and what you apparently experience within you, you in fact experience with the whole wide world outside. In one of the Title 8 meditations, you can find it there, I pointed out that as we observe the outer world, we continually grow together with it, and that it is quite mistaken to distinguish between an outer and inner world as such. If we were really to articulate what we see, we could only regard as our inner experience what our mind experiences as surrounding us. That is what constitutes our inner experience. Many mystics feel uncomfortable with this idea, for they place much emphasis on inner contemplation. But this inward contemplation is usually nothing other than referring to certain corporeal ideas of the outer world as inward, and even renaming them as our divine interiority and such like. These are favored ideas which we borrow from the outer world. We ought, really, to designate as inward what we can see without preconception and usually call outward. In a sense, we are within ourselves in what comes before our gaze. And then, ultimately, we are also really far more at home, let us say, in the moment when all of you are sitting here in this hall, than in your so-called inwardness, especially when you refer to what is inside your skull, behind your eyes, as your interiority. However you may think about this interiority, apart from a few concepts, really very sparse ones, that you have taken from anatomy or physiology, you know very little about what lies behind your eyes or goes on inside your skull. And if you ask which is more inward, what is going on around me in this hall or what lies under my skull, you will be able to recognize that what is around you in the hall is doubtless more inward than what is happening under your skull. At least at this moment your inward life is touched far more by the apparently outer world in this hall than by processes occurring under your skull. The latter are very external to your experience, and you do not really impinge at all on your interiority. And when you objectively relate what you see, you will acknowledge that the outward is really inward, and the inward is, for the human mind, very much outward. Now you may say that these ideas are mere hair-splitting. Well, not initially, since they derive from elucidation of what is really perceived as opposed to theoretical deductions or proofs. This is what one can actually perceive, actually see. It is immediately present to consciousness and would be regarded as true if people only attested to what is actually present to the mind, rather than reconstructing reality in terms of preconceived notions. This is the point of departure, but it has an important consequence. As long as you hold to the notion that things outside you are external, and what is within you is internal, you cannot arrive at what I describe as acknowledging spiritual scientific realities through healthy common sense. You see, spiritual scientific realities can only be perceived and comprehended if we start from a mode of seeing without preconceptions. Then these realities can be recognized, long before we develop any clairvoyant capacities as such. Employing the tangled concepts of modern daily life makes it very difficult, by contrast, to recognize reality. That we see the outer world, or what we usually call the outer world, as we do, in a way that if truly seen and defined encompasses our inner life, is due to our senses, and is connected with the way they are fashioned. We live in the immediate present through our senses. We experience what occurs around us in the present moment through our senses. They make us witnesses of the present moment. But as we are given up to the outer world, our ideas arise from our sense perceptions, and we bear these onward in our memory. We recall later what we experienced in a present moment now gone, and carry it on within us. This largely composes our concepts. Human concepts are mostly memory pictures of what we have drawn from the so-called outer world. But these pictures, ideas, concepts are mediated, not engendered, but mediated by what we otherwise know as our interiority, and which we have now come to see is outward. What lies behind your eyes, of which you really know nothing, mediates ideas and concepts. This is quite definitely the case. It mediates concepts and ideas. But what is actually occurring within your head? If you observe what actually occurs inside the human head, it cannot be said that insofar as we think or picture, we are likewise a witness of processes in the present, as much as is the case in our sense perceptions. In our thinking, this is not so. In the activity of thinking, the activity in which we engaged prior to birth or before conception works on within our head. In other words, what occurs within the head, there's a drawing, while you are thinking or picturing, is not an activity you engage in by virtue of living in the present moment. Instead, you think by virtue of the reverberation of an activity that you engaged in between death and rebirth, or conception, in the supersensible world. You are only a contemporary human being by virtue of perceiving with your senses. As you open your senses to the outer world, you perceive the present moment and live as a contemporary with the external present. But the moment you begin to think, something plays into your skull that is not what you presently are as a human being. The reverberation of what you were in the world of spirit before birth or before conception. If you wish to imagine this more pictorially, you can say, I strike a tone that goes on reverberating long after I struck it. Now imagine that during the whole period between your last death and this birth, you were engaged in an activity in the world of spirit, which I can draw schematically as follows, and there's a drawing. This activity goes on reverberating, and this reverberating activity is when you engage in, when you think in the present. When thinking, you are not engaging in an activity of your present human nature, but it is rather a reverberation of the activity you engaged in between your last death and latest birth. You are only a person of the present in your sensory nature. In thinking, you practice an activity which is a reverberation of what you engaged in before birth in the supersensible world. It simply is not true that in thinking we practice an activity that originates in the present. If you examine what is occurring in the present in your brain, study it scientifically, you will, of course, only find material processes, since what is at work in a non-material realm in your skull is a pre-birth quality which is only echoing on. The fact that a person not only emerges from the supersensible world, but in living here and now in the present, re-experiences what he engaged in during his existence in the supersensible world is living proof for someone who can truly see. If you imagine that you experienced a severe pain here in this physical world, and that as it goes on reverberating in you, it no longer has a physical cause, you can say, similarly, that your thinking in the present is the echo, the reverberation, of what you experienced in a far more intensive manner before you were conceived and began to develop your sensory nature. Thus only in sense perception are we people of the present. If we were this alone, we would never think, since thinking is not given us by virtue of being born into this physical world, but by our ability to let reverberate the activity we exercised before birth or conception in the world of spirit, and by applying this activity to the sense world surrounding us. We can never understand this if we start from ordinary concepts of, in quotes, outer and, in quotes, inner. And least of all will we understand the true state of affairs if we start from a foolish mysticism reigning in so many minds today and teaching that the realm of supersensible human experience is in some way to be found within. What we should seek, rather, is the pre-birth condition. In pointing beyond the outer world of the senses, you ought not to point inward, but instead back to the time you spent prior to conception and birth. From this present person, you should go out into the pre-present person, and then you really are entering the supersensible realm. That is the important thing. Because of a reluctance to work their way through to this sound concept, people speak in words that have no real content, of all kinds of divine interiority and such like. The inner nature people seek in this way in their present being should be sought instead in what we were before we were conceived for our present life. And when we act, when will passes into action, let us consider the simplest kind of action. We walk around a room. That's an action, isn't it? First, we see ourselves walking about. People are unaware of how will is connected with walking, just as little as we are ordinarily aware of what we experience in sleep. Just as we see the color blue, or a tree, or stars, we can outwardly observe what this individual of flesh and blood is doing as he walks about. We can observe ourselves. But we know nothing of how we will. All we know is that someone is walking about, and this is us. And since we must identify this person walking about as ourselves, we say, quote, "I want to walk about," close quote. But how exactly this wanting is connected with the walking about is something quite definitely removed from our ordinary awareness. Well, this in turn is closely related to what we usually call externality and interiority. As you walk about and therefore are moving your legs, you can observe your legs moving, and there's a drawing. You can watch this fellow walking about and can discern what he wishes. You see an outer occurrence. But here you can gain a far greater sense of an actual human interiority. For although you cannot perceive how the will is connected with the walking, nevertheless you infer your will from this walking. You can see this more easily here than in the sense world. You can more easily think of this walking about as having an inner quality than you can the content of the sense world. Where will passes into action, it is easier to see that there is an inner quality at work. Naturally, this is not something that modern mystics care for in their view that outward action is an outward matter and that we must penetrate into inner divine nature within, which is the true human being, and so forth. But just as we have here, and there's a drawing, something inward in sense perception, and something outward within the supposed interiority of the human head. So here this interiority contrasts with our limb system. And now we arrive at this remarkable thought which cannot easily be reconciled with things that people prove today, but which curiously is true if we consider the matter without preconception. However, I believe that the mood of soul prevailing today is of a kind, forgive me, I also have to speak of such things, where numerous Philistines think that the region of the cosmos unfolding below their diaphragm is very much connected with their interior nature. People regard it as something related to their inner life. In fact, it is the most external of all within us. If we call this, see the drawing again, outward, we can regard what lies below the diaphragm as the most outward aspect of the human being. What lies below the diaphragm, the human abdomen, is the most outward aspect of all in us. Every tree, every stone we see is inwardly closer to us than our abdomen, which is the most absolutely outward aspect. Our sense perceptions are our true interiority, what we perceive as our actions. The content of our head is already outward, and most outward of all is what lies below the human chest. This is to really acknowledge what can be seen. It can be seen. Look, this in turn has a very specific significance. Since we have been developing anthroposophy, we repeatedly say, don't we, that when a person is awake, his I, capital, and astral body are within the physical and etheric body. This is true. And when someone sleeps, while he is asleep, his I and astral body are outside the physical and etheric body. I have often pointed out what the nature of this outsideness largely consists of. The aspect of the I and astral body, normally within the head, submerges itself in what lies below the diaphragm. You can even get something like empirical proof of this. Imagine you're dreaming of the loveliest snakes. This is because you have just awoken from your immersion in your own abdomen, where you perceived the intestines. This memory of a perception of the intestines conjures your dream of beautiful snakes. If we are talking from our own perspective as human beings, outward and inward only acquire palpable reality if we know what is really outward, what is really inward in us. And in turn, only when we can acquire such ideas, rather than ones that can be, in quotes, proven, ideas instead that can be seen, then it becomes possible for us to comprehend spiritual, scientific insights with our healthy common sense. This is because whatever we initiate through the will springs in a certain way from the most outward aspect of our nature. Now, let us consider the healthy nature of an idea that must replace a really very pathological one. People believe that when they will something, this comes from within them. In fact, it springs from our most outward aspect, from what we absolutely do not inhabit while we are awake during the day. The aspect which we may at most inhabit when we are asleep. When we will something, we are not inside ourselves at all, but in the cosmos. We accomplish something that is a cosmic occurrence, and by no means merely our own subjective occurrence. Throughout my whole writing life, I have endeavored to teach the contemporary world concepts that are in this sense healthy ones. You can start with my title, Introduction to Goethe's Scientific Writings, where I sought to draw on Goethe's worldview to replace sick concepts with healthy ones. There I pointed out that certain occurrences in the human being can only be properly considered if we do not think something is merely happening inside a person, that it is simply the person concerned who is doing it. Instead, we must regard this so-called human interior as the stage upon which the cosmos enacts human actions, as the stage for cosmic occurrences. On the penultimate and last page of my little book titled Truth and Science, I summed up its whole elaboration of epistemological ideas in the thought that the human being is a stage for what the cosmos enacts within him, and that he does it in connection with the cosmos, not from within. This is the most important section of that book, these last two pages. It was originally my doctoral thesis. But because these two pages are the most important and significant, most keenly grappling with things in modern thinking that need to change, I was only able to shape this little book as it now appears after I had been awarded my doctorate. These last two pages were missing from the original thesis I submitted, since the academic world could not have been expected to countenance conclusions which have some bearing on reconfiguring the whole modern worldview. The original dissertation laid the epistemological ground for this in a relatively inoffensive way, in terms of an objective philosophical treatise. But where it tended could only be added in a later printing. Only when we really practice this exact seeing I have spoken of, no longer simply succumbing to illusions that are elicited by preconceived views, one will also be able to develop healthy insights into the nature of the human will. What we see outside us when a person walks around, or when we observe ourselves performing the simplest actions, moving our legs forward, say, is only the inner aspect of the will. The most outward aspect of it, which has meaning for the cosmos, is apparently concealed within us. Yet concealed within our most outward aspect lives something spiritual that underlies what we are reluctant to call inward. What occurs within this, the spiritual aspect, of course not what physically happens, but the spiritual aspect parallel to the physical action, is again not something of the present moment. Of the present moment is what we observe the person doing. But what occurs within is something else, is in fact something only germinally beginning to occur. As you walk about, or as you perform some other actions with your limbs, something occurs in your outward nature that has real meaning after death. It is the prelude to processes that will occur between death and your subsequent rebirth. Just as what lives in your thinking is the echo of what you were in the world of spirit between your previous death and latest birth or conception. What resonates in your most outward aspect, which people call the most inward, is the embryo of processes that you will enact between your next death and following rebirth. We only comprehend and perceive human will if we do not once again consider the human being at this moment, but instead see in him, apparently in him, though it lives in his most outward aspect, the correlate to actions, something belonging to them, that departs through the portal of death, thereafter becoming activity between death and a new birth, developing there too, in such a way that it can once again enter us and continue to reverberate in our outward nature. If we study the human will, trying to find in the person we are at this moment the mystical depths of this will, the divine origins of this will, then phrase-monger mystics usually find that they should not do this only in their belly, since this isn't quite elegant enough for them. They are not actually concerned with truth, but with special, unctuous turns of phrase. If we seek the truth instead, we find that something that has, let us say, in an unappetizing connection with physical sense reality is a correlate to what departs through the portal of death and continues into a subsequent existence. Here we must seek our future being, thus we gain from thinking evidence of our pre-birth existence, and from our will evidence of our life after death, as I have often explained here, and even sometimes in public lectures. These are truths we do really need to become aware of today. It is essential to realize that human thinking is something that cannot actually be produced by us at this present moment with our flesh and blood, our bones and nerves, but that it reverberates from a life before birth. And that will is by no means something that we can produce in our present entirety, in the present moment, but that it has an aspect which survives beyond death. If we really come to recognize what cannot be produced by us in our present form of flesh and blood, then we begin to see the human being before us as eternal in nature. We do not acquire these truths by speculating about eternity, but rather by becoming able to engage really positively with a nature of thinking on the one hand and will on the other. This is essential. If we seek to develop higher insights today that accord with modern spiritual science, we must regard phrase-mongering mysticism as the most injurious of things. And this is why certain things one puts in writing from the perspective of authentic spiritual science should be accepted. They often are. But then people start objecting when it comes to the really important thing, to engage with the specific, detailed realities of human life. It's at that point that people turn instead to the chatter of dabbling mystics who try to conjure an inner world from words. But the society and culture of today are in too grave a crisis for us to luxuriate in such mystic generalities. What we need to do today is engage with matters that configure the human soul in such a way that people really acquire these ideas and use them to understand society and what lives in it. Will anyone develop truly social ideas if he cannot see? If he learns to approach reality with the prejudices and preconceptions of the academic and scientific mode of thinking? We only acquire a capacity to perceive reality cleanly if we free ourselves through the ideas of spiritual science from the undergrowth of prevailing outlooks, whose ultimate consequence can be found in many mystical aberrations of our day. The mystical aberrations of our time are not signs of a new resurgence toward a better condition. Often they are the last stage in decline, the ultimate extremity of mere empty phrases, rather than true insights. True insights tell us such things as that thinking is the echo and reverberation of life before birth, and will a prelude to life after death. These are specific insights. In speaking of such detailed realities, we speak in a quite different way from those who say merely that something eternal, the divine I, lives in our temporal nature, and that if we experience ourselves in this eternal being, we encompass our divine nature, the true I, as opposed to the untrue I, and so forth. We can spend all day playing around with such ideas, and it may engender a great sense of well-being in us, but it will not lead us to real insights. The end of Lecture 8.